location of the country's latest mass shooting is revealed. Obama meets with America's schizophrenic voices to urge less bloodshed, and desperate Americans everywhere just try to get on board with senseless violence. Buckle your seatbelts, put your computer away, and never watch web videos while driving. This is The Onion Week in Review. As news of the Federal Reserve Chairman nomination process continued to unfold this week, The Onion maintained its continued journalistic integrity by refusing to cover any part of the shameless clickbait involving the nation's banking system. Onion reporters spoke candidly about their decision, saying that readers visiting theonion.com will see no mention of eye-catching names like Janet Yellen or Lawrence Summers, and will never be lured into clicking on titillating articles about the history of the Federal Reserve Board. According to a new report released this week by the Department of Transportation, the average American scoots over approximately 10 miles per year on park benches, baseball bleachers, and picnic tables. The study, which also accounted for scooching, sliding over, and moving on down, found that over the course of their lifetimes, most Americans ultimately scoot several times the length of the English Channel, the coastline of Uruguay, or the length of the Tigris River.
Between the various types of communal seating, the typical American scoots nearly 1 mile each month, and if you count instances of scooting over, seeing the other person has already found a place, and then scooting back, many Americans travel much farther by scooting than they do by motor vehicle.
While out for drinks with coworkers this Wednesday, local shipping clerk Russell Chambliss told reporters he was extremely unsure if he was being bullied by his male colleagues or bonding with them. Chambliss said that while he was repeatedly demeaned and physically tormented by his male coworkers throughout the evening, they nonetheless did it in a collegial manner, leaving him ultimately unsure whether to feel insulted or honored.
I'm pretty sure that Bill called me limp dick earlier, and Todd keeps punching me in the shoulder. Pretty hard, too. I told Jeff about this problem that I was having with my girlfriend, and he called me a pussy and then walked away. But then, like 5 minutes later, he came back with a beer that he had bought for me. What does that even mean?
And in local news, a grandmother is shown around the retirement home where she will die. In other news, a 250-pound man is sadly in the best shape of his life. Grand Theft Auto V is a sophisticated gaming experience, according to a man who spent 3 hours running over homeless people with a fire truck.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From Washington, your nation's capital, the National Broadcasting Company brings you the special Constitution Day address of the President of the United States. On the grassy, moonlit slopes of the Washington Monument grounds are more than 75,000 persons eagerly awaiting the address of the President. From the special platform in the Sylvan Theater, the chief executive faces the great stone obelisk that honors the first president of our nation. To the right of the speaker's platform in flag-draped boxes are the members of the diplomatic corps, and to the left the cabinet, members of Congress, and other distinguished guests. This great open-air ceremony climaxes a day-long celebration arranged by the United States Constitution Sesquicentennial Commission under the direction of the Honorable Sol Bloom, member of Congress from New York. He is presiding, and we present Mr. Bloom.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. My fellow Americans. It is very right, it is very fitting that this great gathering has assembled tonight in the national capital at the foot of the Washington Monument. 150 years ago tonight, 38 weary delegates to a convention in Philadelphia signed the Constitution. 4 handwritten sheets of parchment were enough to state the terms on which 13 independent, weak, little republics agreed to try to survive together as one strong nation. A third of the original delegates had given up and gone home. But the moral force of Washington and Franklin had kept the rest together. Those remained who cared the most, and caring most, dared most. That world of 1787 provided a perfect opportunity for the organization of a new form of government, thousands of miles removed from influences hostile to it. How we then governed did not greatly concern Europe, and what occurred in Europe did not immediately affect us. But today the picture is different. What we do now has enormous immediate effect, not only among the nations of Europe, but also among those of the Americas and the Far East. And what in any part of the world they do, as surely and quickly affects us. In such an atmosphere, our generation has watched democracies replace monarchies which had failed their people, and dictatorships displaced democracies which had failed to function. And of late we have heard a clear challenge to the democratic idea of representative government. We do not deny that the methods of the challengers, whether they be called communistic or dictatorial or military, have obtained for many who live under them material things they did not obtain under democracies which they had failed to make function. Unemployment has been lessened, even though the cause is a mad manufacturing of armaments. Order prevails, even though maintained by fear at the expense of liberty and individual rights. So their leaders laugh at all constitutions, predict the copying of their own methods, and prophesy the early end of democracy throughout the world.
Coming up, it's at the center of so many of our debates these days. There it is right there. It's the U.S. Constitution. Is it perhaps the problem and not the solution?
Sheep, beware. Monsters under the bed. Smell the scent of fear. Shepherd kings wearing wool pack owls now bow down. Feel the power of the great old owls. Deception, ride the nightmare stallion of hell's fire. Flames rage, walking zombie brain slaves. Loud rats in a chaotic maze. Consume the culture, strip the skin off the bones. Carnivorous vulture scavenge the carcass of gold. Snakes, venom, and vampire bloodlust. A beast's greed and an ivory tusk.
Hey everybody, another great day waiting for you.
With only enough money to keep the government running another 11 days, Republican leaders say they will approve new funding only if Obamacare is defunded.
Otherwise, we're going to have a government shutdown.
Here they go again.
It seems like the Republican Party is in disarray.
Hail Mary move or extortion.
It's an ill-conceived tactic and Republicans should reject it.
Back in March, Speaker Boehner argued that risking a government shutdown was a losing strategy.
That is not our goal.
But that's crazy.
Yesterday, after losing that argument, he officially capitulated.
The House will pass a CR that locks the sequester savings in and defunds Obamacare.
Taking one for the team. Yeah. Hashtag it out.
My head's about to explode. So
it's about Republicans versus Republicans.
Some friction on the Republican side.
The smack talk continues.
That's right.
This is a huge victory for the Tea Party.
Yes or no? Would you do this even if it risks shutting down the government?
Yes.
Okay.
Why not?
Every Senate Republican should stand with Republicans in the House.
It's like a scene straight from Mission Impossible.
They're not going to get into the ifs, ands, and buts. Obamacare is driving up the cost of health care, destroying millions of American jobs.
That's how he's doing it?
Give it up. Quit this.
It is a train wreck. It has to go.
God bless them. They really believe this stuff. They really believe that you should shut down the government.
Any day that the government is not working is a good day for working Americans.
Lie to me.
Ultimately, these Republicans do get the sense kicked into them.
We can't let the government shut down. We can't be kamikazes, and we can't be General Custom.
It would be good political theater if there were not so much at stake.
11 more days of this to go, Carol.
Can't wait.
And the burden is on the few of us. Slumber, break the spell I'm under. Light of day, love is the way.
At least 60 people have been killed in a suicide attack on a church in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. Medical officials say more than 100 others were injured, including women and children. There were two explosions as up to 600 worshippers were leaving the church.
Prison planet full of starving souls, slavery systems, environmental control, puppet presidents, corporate clones, monetary gains from military war zones, BlackRock helicopters. Nature's falling. Can we tune into the frequency?
Okay, let's take a live update on that breaking story. Gunmen opening fire inside an upmarket shopping mall in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, today. Armed police are said to be at the scene at the Westgate Mall, right in the city centre. News agencies reporting that a fierce gun battle is going on. There are reports of casualties. So far, no official confirmation on the number of dead or injured. Let's cross live now to our bureau and our correspondent, Anne Soy. Anne, just get us right up to speed. What do we know?
Well, what you know now is that the police inspector general is at the scene now. We are waiting for his statement to start any time now. What we also know is that the police has now taken charge of the ground floor of that shopping mall. But we also know that there are hostages who've been held up there. Some of them have been communicating with us. One of them told us that she had gunshots, and then everything just went, all hell broke loose. And she's currently still held up in that shopping mall. The police has asked people to keep off from that scene. We know in Kenya that when you have incidents like this, people tend to rush to the scene. The police has totally surrounded the shopping mall, and so we are waiting for a statement anytime now.
Apparently, it's quite an affluent area frequented by a lot of expats, we understand.
That's right. This is located just near the UN headquarters here. It is an area that is inhabited mainly by people who work for embassies and people who work for expatriates who work for the United Nations. And this is a shopping mall that is particularly popular with foreigners. And so we're waiting to see what the hostage situation is there. There's a Reuters photographer who's tweeted saying that he saw what appeared to be five dead bodies. There hasn't been any confirmation whatsoever from the police. But we're expecting an update anytime now.
There is love and inspiration. We aspire to a higher vibration. Ego, head to go. See the phoenix soar. Say
nation with the World Tree and the power of life, polar energy. Original intention, spiritual connection with the World Tree.
To spare $7.8 million to play with? Well, why not bid for a solid gold and diamond encrusted model of a mini Lamborghini? And the best part? You can't even drive it. A 22-carat gold-plated replica is currently on display in a showroom in Dubai, ahead of the world tour for the real deal later this year. The model Aventador LP704 Coupe on display is valued at $2.9 million, but the one being crafted out of solid gold and precious gems has a starting price tag of $7.8 million. Once completed, the 25-inch model, which is 8 times smaller than the real sports car, will be sold at auction. 10% of the proceeds will be donated to charity. According to the manufacturers, the model will scoop 3 Guinness World Records for the most expensive and precious model car, the most luxurious logo, and the world's most secure showcase.
The real problem in the city is Lamborghinis.
Folks, as you know, in the absence of breaking news, cable news channels rely on a variety of one tactic to hold the viewer's attention: concise, informative reporting. It's actually this.
Can I finish?
No, Miss.
You wanted me to answer a question?
You're lying.
I'm not lying.
You are lying.
All right, that's it. Get her out of here.
You're going to go back to 1996?
Yes, I am.
Do you know what I think? You can't tell me what I think.
Let me finish.
I'm sorry.
You wouldn't know what American exceptionalism is if it smacked you in the face.
Now, good simultaneous points, everybody. But that looks so long to watch. Can we distill cable news down to its crunchy center? When I said let's have a baboon masturbating, I didn't think we could find that footage. Wow, we have the best research staff in the country. But of course, that's just 24-hour cable filler, slow news day, conflict chum. It's what cable news channels do while waiting for events that truly justify their existence. Urgent, soul-crushing, breaking news, like a mass shooting. The kind that now happens all too frequently in this, for some reason, pathologically unable to try and stop them country. It's times like these that we require the type of context and clarity that only these noble, dormant cable giants. Why are you laughing? Can provide.
I pause a moment and I start to realize he's telling lies.
I don't want to speculate, but
I'm sorry, did I say context and clarity? I meant speculation. Yes, for every all-too-familiar American tragedy, you can be sure the news will exacerbate it with yet another Force 5 wrong NATO. Get inside, everybody! Get inside! Get inside! And hope for a power outage!
If there were as many as 3 shooters, that would change this situation dramatically.
Right now, NBC News has the report of just one shooter. There were earlier reports about multiple shooters.
There has been a name that's been reported, but we're told that the name that's out there is incorrect.
By the end of the rampage, Alexis had a shotgun, he had a handgun, he had an AR-15. There were initial reports from authorities that the shooter in this case used an AR-15. That apparently now is not true.
Again, we're just speculating here, but this is experience speculation.
Oh, yes it is. You know, I'm an old hand when it comes to speculation. Been doing it since you were a gleam in your pappy's eyes.
the first one who suggested John F. Kennedy was killed by spontaneous combustion. Turned out to be wrong, but
he's telling.
But you know, for sheer accumulation of breathless wrongness, there's really only one source that matters.
This is CNN.
A little bit of a buzz here, some activity here. Not sure exactly what that means. This is down 11th Street. You see a couple of officers rushing down the street toward those flashing lights. You've seen some tactical vehicles moving around here. We saw at least four SWAT team members with helmets on, what appear to be night vision goggles. We can see some of these squad cars around here. This apparently is some kind of a rescue chopper, and we've seen kind of a rescue a basket or something. That's about as low as we've seen him go. So that is kind of an interesting development.
No, that's not an interesting development. Those aren't interesting developments. You're just standing in front of a camera naming you see. It's not anything. It's like walking down the street with a five-year-old. Police car. Buy a hide one. For some reason, CNN felt the need to include their search for even the most banal of background facts.
Paul Corson, are you on the line? Paul Corson? Let's go to Barbara Starr again because she knows about this building. How large is this building, Barbara? Barbara's on the phone with her sources gathering more information. Mike Brooks, do you know the answer to that question? How large is this building? All right, let's go to Todd Sperry. Are you on the line? Todd Sperry?
Yes, I'm here. I am here.
Okay, Todd, tell us how large this building is. Do you know?
Can someone just tell her how the building is? I'm gonna tell her! Just tell her how large the building is, someone please! We're not gonna get to move forward until she finds out how large this building is. We're in square footage wormhole territory here!
Well, I never had this problem. Nobody in the government. Guess I always figured they never mean what they meant. And God help us all not to be so stone surprised when we wake up in the stars with the skies in our eyes. If we keep telling lies, 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 lies.
And then, inevitably, Blitzer.
The fact, Tom, that this individual described as someone dressed in a black top, black jeans, what does that say, if anything, about a possible motive or whatever? Can we begin to draw any initial conclusions?
What does a black top and black jeans say about possible motive? I don't know. Why don't you ask your best colleague? But perhaps the worst part of the Blitzer reportage, besides using phrases like, can we begin to draw any initial conclusions? That's kind of a semantic workaround for saying, make up. I'm on until 4. It's CNN's brash on-air acknowledgement that they should not be doing this at all.
What does that say, if anything, about a possible motive or whatever? Can we begin to draw any initial conclusions? And I want to alert our viewers, sometimes these initial conclusions can obviously be very, very wrong.
Yes, 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 correct. They can be very, very wrong. So don't say them out loud. If it's an urge inside of you that you have to get out, have a speculation jar.
Holy, I think this is a terror attack or a nuclear bomb. Oh my God, we're all gonna die.
Oh no, here we go.
It's like a compulsion.
If there are two shooters, Wolf, if that proves to be correct, it is going to be the most significant fact.
That's a startling piece of information if that is, in fact, turns out to be accurate.
This may be information he believes to be accurate that he's been given, but that turns out to be inaccurate.
In a situation like this, the information that is flowing so quickly is often wrong.
That's right.
And you now have some information for us.
I know you think that saying this could all be wrong makes it okay to say it, but it doesn't make it okay. No one else in the world is allowed to operate that way.
Hello, I'm your doctor. You have cancer, of course. Obviously, a lot of my initial diagnoses are very, very wrong. That being said, you have cancer. Unless you don't, these test results are just coming in here so fast and furious. And I can't wait. I'll know for sure in an hour if you have cancer or not, but f*** it. You have cancer. I just gotta get it out. And that's when I realized.
All of yesterday's confusion in the reporting, it's not a mistake. Because sadly, the one thing in this country they should have great practice in covering are these horrific shooting tragedies. And there are a ton of really smart people and good journalists who work over at CNN. And this is only 5 months after all the criticism of CNN's chaotic Boston terrorism coverage, including when they announced on air an arrest that had not happened. Initial conclusion is this is deliberate. The chaos they vomit onto the screen, the very thing we thought news organizations were created to clarify, is a feature, not a bug. Here's CNN's boss describing the lesson they learned from their Boston coverage.
So we made that mistake on the Wednesday of that Boston coverage. 2 days later, as the drama unfolded in Boston, we had our biggest audience in 10 years. You know who got it? You know who understood that we made a mistake and we acknowledged it? The audience.
Oh my God. The lesson they take from this is, it doesn't matter how much they betray our trust, we'll keep coming back. We're in an abusive relationship with CNN. And it's time we kick those bastards to the curb, because we have to remember, this network was created by Ted Turner, not Ike Turner.
Let's just make a McNuggets in my hand. I don't want to hear it.
It's 10:30 a.m. We don't serve chicken McNuggets at this time.
Yes, you do.
No, we don't.
Why not?
Because we do.
You know what?
Did you just hiss at me?
I'm the one just hiss at you.
Hey, can't you just give me your ass out of the car? What's going on over there?
Don't you run away from me, you family. Don't make me assume my ultimate form. I will you up. Just wait. I'm going to come in and I'm going to wreck you.
Oh, sinner, do not stray from the straight and narrow way, for the Lord is surely watching what you do. If you approach the devil's den, turn round, don't enter in, lest the hand of the Almighty fall on you. He'll fuck you up.
He'll fuck you up.
Yes, God will fuck you up. If you dare to disobey his stern command, he'll fuck you up.
He'll fuck you up.
Don't you know he'll fuck you up? So you better do some praying while you can. Long ago, a man named Lot had a wife he thought was hot, but she could not stop her black and sinful ways. You know it was her own damn fault when God turned that bitch to salt. That's the way he used to work back in those days.
A belief in an angry, vengeful God is correlated with mental illness. However, that doesn't tell us anything about causation. We've talked for a long time on the show about how there are some specific religious beliefs that, when you kind of interpret them literally, would make you question whether that person is sane. Ross Story has an interesting story about a scientific study that published this month in the Journal of Religion and Health. And it says people who believe in an angry, punishing God are more likely to suffer from a variety of mental illnesses. And this was conducted by Marymount Manhattan College assistant psychology professor Nava Silton. And she used data from the 2010 Baylor Religion Survey of U.S. adults and found that there are links between, before even getting into that, she looked at this through the lens of the evolutionary threat assessment system theory, which says that the part of the brain that evolves to detect threats also connects to anxiety disorders, and dysfunction in the brain's perception of threats is really what is at root there. And by the same token, if your brain cannot properly analyze threats, and that in part connects with believing that there is a threat from an angry God who will send you to hell, that could be connected with all sorts of different conditions, including anxiety, depression, irrational fears, other psychiatric symptoms. So there is kind of a correlation here that we're seeing, but this does not mean that if you believe in an angry, vengeful God, it will cause you to have mental illness. That is not what is being said here.
Right.
What is interesting, though, is that we've talked about other studies over the last couple of years on the show, Lewis, that show that the parts of the brain specifically evolved to detect threats are the same parts that those who vote conservative have more developed, according to MRI scans. If you vote liberal, you're likely to have a more developed empathy part of your brain versus a fear part. And we've also talked about the correlation between authoritarian parenting and the effect that that has on the eventual political beliefs of the child. More conservative, the more authoritarian the parents are. This is all related, I think.
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you go way back, of course, it was only logical to believe about these crazy things. And for millennia, people did. And I mean, so does believing
that... For millennia, people did. But for millions and millions of years before that, people did not.
There might have been no concept of it. Sure. But if for thousands of years people did, we probably can't say that it causes mental illness, because I think everyone would have just declined, really.
He really fucked them up. When the people went and turned their backs on him, he can fuck you up. No, they should fuck you up. Just like he fucked up the people up back then. I used to have a friend named Ray who walked that evil way. He cursed and drank and broke his neighbor's fans. You know Ray was full aware that some sheep were over there, and he knew them in the biblical sense. God fucked him up. He went and fucked Ray up. Went and paid him back for all his wicked sins. He fucked him up.
He fucked him up.
That boy completely up. Now he's married to a Presbyterian.
You Catholic. I'm Holy Ghost Funky Gut Bucket Baptist.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
Unfortunately, more increasingly in society, we're always walking on eggshells with our feelings. We're always worried about that slightest little tap, that insult that'll set us over the edge and snap us like an egg. What happens when this becomes the norm? Seems to be the norm where the society is handcuffed to now medication on a regular basis. So depression keeps them locked up. Just walking pill heads, unfortunately. There is some people that really do need the medication for pain, but most of them are just trying to cope with everyday problems. Where have we gone wrong? Where? Why? Why can't we just deal with ourselves anymore? Why is it so hard to get a grasp? In the early 60s and 70s, Valium took the spotlight and slowly faded away into much harder uses. But I wonder how much of that still remains. In 3 decades, did it entwine itself with people's DNA? It's a question to be asked. Is it something now that's almost codependent, and that's why we have this instant draw to these drugs? In a society already reeling from stress, let it be financial, let it be hardship. The bottom line is, we have a sick society. There's 150 million people right now on these beta blockers and psychoinhibitors. The picture is definitely not clear, not in their eyes. The picture is not clear in my eyes either, and I'm not on them. And the reason why it's not clear in my eyes is, how do you give a society such a drug? And why would you do that? Why would you place this medication on people? These drugs known as SSRIs. Let's listen in to Dr. Coles and hear his thoughts on this.
What are SSRI drugs?
Okay. That's the abbreviation for selective serotonin reuptake pump inhibitors, SSRI.
Whoa, that's a mouthful.
Mouthful. So SSRI is kind of a easy way to explain something that we doctors don't understand. You know?
Great. Okay.
So we get this propaganda from the drug industry representatives who come and give us samples and wine and dine us and don't tell us.
Okay.
And they don't tell us everything that we should know about using these very dangerous and addicting medications that alter the brain. If I had at least long term, maybe permanently in some cases, but at least long term, so there are fewer receptor sites, you're getting depleted, running on empty on serotonin, which only comes from food, by the way. The only way to raise serotonin in the brain is to take a nutrient called tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan. There's only two ways to actually raise total. The SSRIs only increase it in the synapse level, and that's temporary, with a lot of damage being done. So that's why there's the Prozac poop-out concept. Mm-hmm. All those drugs poop out. They stop working after a month or so. And so then you have to raise the dose. And now you're getting even more aggravation, maybe a little more effect, but again, that's temporary. So.
But isn't that the typical pattern with all drugs, whether they're legal or illegal?
Not to take from the seriousness of the issue, but when I watch this lady, I keep thinking of that woman in the Poltergeist.
There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her.
Yeah, that's true, and that's they call that tolerance. The mm-hmm. psychiatric term is tolerance. It works for a while, and then your body gets tolerant to it, and you lose its effect.
So you develop a tolerance for these drugs.
Yeah, so you have to increase the dose. And then if you try to quit, your brain now is dependent. That's where the dependency term comes. Your brain is dependent on the drug, and you're going through withdrawal. You're craving, or something's wrong, and the only cure is to take another hit. So if you're a cocaine addict and you run out your supply, you're anxious. You're searching everywhere for a dealer to get some more cocaine, or if it's Ritalin, which is the same as cocaine, molecular structure-wise, you're wanting to get another prescription or go to the street. And if you're a Zoloft user and you run out of your Zoloft, and you're frantic to get another dose because you're withdrawing within a day or two or three of some of these medications. So yes, they are addicting. Everybody. You know, if they take it for a short time, or if it's a low dose, or you're well-nourished, perhaps, and not on any other drugs, maybe you can take it for a few weeks or a few months and then quit out a lot of withdrawal symptoms. Those are multiple medications. It's highly likely that you're going to have terrible withdrawal symptoms that may make it impossible for you to get off, or very difficult to get off without going crazy from the withdrawal. And we all know the picture of the heroin addict, that they throw in a padded cell, and he just sweats and he vomits and he has pain and he's just miserable. And then he eventually, may get a little bit better, but he probably hasn't. That's not very good treatment. He needs to be slowly withdrawn. He needs to be well nourished. He needs to be hydrated. He needs to have some nutritional help. Mm-hmm. And yet we despise heroin addicts, we despise codeine addicts. But we don't despise Zoloft addicts or Prozac addicts, do we? Or Ritalin addicts.
It's totally acceptable.
Now, as you heard from the doctor, these happy pills aren't so happy in the end. The shakes and the tremors that people receive are very much the same withdrawals as heroin users. Lives bleed out, become shaky, become blurred. How do you function in society without the pills? What happens if there is no pills? It's often said that with these withdrawals, people snap. So I've been keeping my eye on this article for a while now, and I caught this back in, I believe it was June of this year, from CBS News. And it basically shows a study that 70% of Americans were on some sort of allopathic drugs. Now here's the shocking number. Now I don't usually buy into mainstream media, but I always gauge the bullshit with it. And this was important right here. Nearly 1 in 4 women, the ages of 50 to 60, 1 in 4, were on antidepressants. That's 13% of the population. So how does this much of society become this ill and diagnosed with this many problems? Well, this is how. Let's watch this clip.
Hot, fast,
slow, or sad.
Maybe sometimes even filled with ups and downs.
But according to psychiatrists, any part of life can be labeled a mental illness.
Really? Like what?
Let's say you're upset after a bad breakup. Well, that could be labeled depression.
What if you're nervous before speaking in public?
Anxiety disorder.
Or being really talkative and super active.
Manic.
That sounds a little crazy.
It does.
Oh, but where are these disorders all coming from?
From Psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's 943. Everything from depression and anxiety to stuttering, cigarette addiction, fear of spiders, nightmares, problems with math, and even disorder of infancy. All reinterpreted and many falsely labeled as a brain disease.
But people do have serious problems in life.
Absolutely. But psychiatrists reduce them down to something wrong with your brain.
So let me get this straight. Psychiatrists have a book of life problems reinterpreted as mental disorders?
That's right.
Wow. Then it must be backed up by a lot of science.
You'd think so, but it isn't. Psychiatrists at one of their recent conventions admitted to it. Listen to this.
DSM is made up by committees of men who have political opinion, and women too, who have biases and political opinions. And so there isn't nearly as much science in DSM as there ought to be.
Like in the previous one, people had a meeting in the bathroom and they decided that something should be in there, and then they went, would go and propose it to the whole committee.
You have this kind of lumping together of several observations, and when you get enough of them in one tent, you got a diagnosis.
DSM system is not your real system or diagnosis.
A lot of the disorders that are in there haven't necessarily been rigorously validated.
It's just the best tool that we have available, but it is not perfect.
It's so useless that if you give me a patient and the DSM, I'll make at least 20 diagnoses on the same patient.
You have to take it with a grain of salt anyway.
It's actually getting more and more complicated.
We're left with diagnosing things on the basis of checklists and questionnaires, which leaves us sort of out of, as you said, the rest of medicine because we don't have a biological test.
Amazing.
The lack of science in the DSM.
Well, isn't that just stellar? You pretty much put whatever you want as a disorder. Got itchy ankles? It's a disorder. Eyelashes hurt? It's a disorder. You know, this is the problem. And this is why I like to add these clips into my videos, because I really believe it's good to hear it from another doctor's voice on why we rip ourselves apart on so-called medication. The real horrifying part is it's become somewhat fashionable for youth. They almost brag about it in their electronic world of what drugs that they're on how it's impacting them. It's a scary trend going forward to know that it is almost the hip thing to be on some sort of depressant medication. And the depressing part about that is depression has become fashionable in its own weird way. Now, I don't want to sound like a 40-something male, but I never knew the term emo existed. And it actually stands for emotional. And this was something that was actually a trend that I guess it's still taking place. It's tied in with the latest fashions, and in through this latest fashion, and pop stars often brag about the depression medication that they're on. And it's also glorified and hammed up with a lot of the way you're supposed to act and be like and perceived by society. Now think about this. If you're 12 years old and you're wearing those shoes, by the late 20s, you got a soft-boiled egg for a head. I mean, where do these people become independent at that point? That dependency was made to rope you up, tie you up, weigh on you really heavily, so that when you do come down, you're going to snap. I've read that the violent emotions come pouring out, or you feel like you're constantly spiraling with these brain zaps, as they're called. I'll let this young gentleman sum up how he had to come off of these so-called medications.
Like, for instance, when I got off of Ativan, I was on 1 milligram. In order to get off of that, I had to at first take 1 milligram. Well, I mean, I was already on 1 milligram. Then I had to break it in half and take half a milligram. And then I'd break that in half and take 1/4 of a milligram. And then I had to take 1/4 of a milligram every other day. And then, if I remember right, I think I had to take it every, like, 2 days. Like, skip 2 days and then take it. So it's like once every 3 days, if I remember right. But it says on the chart. But point is, so then after that, that's not all that you got to do, because you can't just get off Ativan like that either. Like, you have to get on Valium and then be on the lowest dose they have, and then you have to wean off of the Valium. You can't just get off of the Ativan by itself. It's just, even that's impossible. Like, you'd be incredibly shocked at how hard it is to get off of a benzo unless you've actually tried it, because withdrawal symptoms are just outrageous. Like, they're horrible. So, I guess I'm trying to keep this video short so it won't take so long to upload it to YouTube.
So that's just one of many thousands of stories that are uploaded on YouTube on how many pills they had to take to wean off the original medication and how hard it was to open up each one of those doors and go through another bout of weaning off another medication. It's just crazy when you look at it. You know, these videos, I put them out there to keep these topics fresh, because a lot of times they get written off as all kinds of different things that people say, but I truly believe it is a problem within our society. It's one of the major problems. What about the soldiers?
About the military's use of antidepressants for soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a incredible investigative story about the military's use of antidepressants to keep soldiers in the theater of war and to treat them when they're at home. And we don't say whether it's a good or a bad thing. I mean, obviously antidepressants help lots and lots of people,
sure.
But we have a medicated military now. Up to 17% of the soldiers in Afghanistan are taking antidepressants, about 12% of the soldiers in Iraq. Now, look, you can hardly blame them.
Yeah,
right?
How does that have an impact, though, on a military man or woman when you consider, we all know people who take antidepressants, and one of the complaints is that it flattens you out a bit. Doesn't this have an impact on how they are as warriors?
We do talk about that, but again, I mean, antidepressants do help a lot of people. They allow the soldiers to sleep better. There's a lot of incredible amounts of loss of sleep and insomnia in theaters of war. And the thing is, though, that's interesting about it is we've never really talked about this before. The military doesn't talk to families about it. We don't talk to the American public about it. So we just wanted to expose this so people would see what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Rick, is this brought about by the fact that this is a war like no other war? Even in World War II, you had front lines. And when the guys got tired in World War II, they'd say, hey, you need to get away from the lines for a while, go back, rest a little bit.
Right.
Every one of these soldiers, every Marine, every airman, every sailor that serves over there knows they could get shot in the back of the head today.
Right.
Is that what is caught in these long rotations?
That's the real question, Joe. The larger issue is about the rotation of personnel.
Where does
into
this part not kick into that whole conversation? Record U.S. troop suicides exceed combat deaths. The number of U.S. troops committing suicide exceed that in combat. Where do they not get this? Where does this not tie into the drugs that they're given? Because they're handed a ton of it. Now, this article says like 15%, but I've read articles all day that are saying 20%. Not just in the U.S. This goes on in the U.K. also. More soldiers commit suicide than are killed in battle. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that we have obviously a big problem. And there's a common denominator.
Yes, debate.
And I guess the balance here is that we are also a medicated society.
Well, that's
right. There are children, millions, on medication. And I'm sure, in fact, you guys have covered that. In a way, it makes sense that
it mirrors the larger society.
Right.
I mean, the percentage of people on antidepressants now compared to 15 years ago, it's an enormous difference. I mean, and why shouldn't the Army and the military reflect society at large? But it's an issue that needs to be discussed and debated, and that's what we're trying
to do. And there's so many of these warriors right now who were kids who got Prozac pushed on them back 10, 15 years ago. Prozac, Ritalin,
right.
And a lot of these other, back when it seemed to me every time we'd go into a doctor's office, our kid would walk through it and they'd try to prescribe Ritalin.
Right.
And we are a medicated society right now.
So let me tie this up. I just hope we can find an answer in the way to solving this crisis. And it is a crisis. It's way out of control. the inner thoughts that we have in our fragile minds. I wish we'd get back to seeing the delicateness of the beauty on how our mind really does work, rather than being tampered with. With that being said, much love, Mr. P. Crackers, and if not, we're off to Wonderland.
But don't worry, we're all going to be living on nothing soon enough. And, you know, with a little bit of help from our friends, maybe, just maybe, I don't know. I have no idea.
When Benjamin Franklin said, "Never tell all you know, nor judge all you see," believe me, Ock, that applied to me. But from the privacy of your world, you bombarded me with emails talking about, if I don't use my blessings to write what you would write if you were me, then I'm going to hell. Well, which one of us is already ready to meet their maker for their beliefs at this very moment? Your faith seems weak when placed beside the truly enlightened, don't it? You should choose your opponents more wisely, namely somebody beside me. You don't understand the spirits that guide me. When did you become God enough to judge what's inside me? How could I allow a self-righteous coward to pretend to have the type of power that thou would in my presence? You don't even understand the universe's lessons. Scared to return to the essence. Rather than passing judgment, you should be asking questions. You need to learn to be humble before you stumble upon a world which you will wish you didn't know exist. So stay out of my affairs and maintain your ignorant bliss. And all this because the poet performed an erotic poem and he felt like his girl might ignore him when the poet was just trying to show him how to keep his own love from getting born. And in his anger, he prophesizes that the poet's soul is in danger, which is dumb, because where does the would-be proselytizer think that the messenger gets his messages from? Like Confucius, no investigation, no right to speak. And if you want to be a clown and pretend that you can condemn my soul to damnation, then don't write to me. Claiming to live righteously and honest, pontificate in your pajamas. See me in the venue but ain't got shit to say until you're safely in the bedroom across the hall from your mamas. And the saddest thing about your kind is you have no idea what the time is. Don't understand what type of spirit alarm is. Can't understand the ancestors that surround this. See, life is mathematic and your soul is off balance, about as righteous as the Israelites when Moses is in the mountains. You think my days are numbered? Well, start counting. But if you're thinking you're spiritual, stop it, because your only concept of God comes from a man who's got his hands deep in your pocket. Why the hell you think they call him a prophet? Whenever you got money, he gonna need you to come off it. Parasite, take your money, tell you lies, lust for your wife. And now you want to use his advice to tell me how to live my life, when I already know it's possible to be myself and still live in God. Trying to convince me of otherwise is ludicrous. Besides, the man who says that it cannot be done should at least be smart enough to keep the hell out of the way of the man who was already doing it, doing it, doing it, doing it, doing it, doing it.
Now, go find the others. .com.
Wait, ding, ding, ding. Uh-oh, looks like we're out of time. Goodbye.